that her only hope of getting their affairs disentangled now lay in his marrying Julie Karagina. "But, Mama, suppose I loved a girl who has no fortune. Would you expect me to sacrifice my feelings and my honour for the sake of money?" he asked his mother, not realizing the cruelty of his question and only wishing to show his noble-mindedness. "No, you have not understood me," said his mother, not knowing how to justify herself. "You have not understood me, Nikolinka. It is your happiness I wish for," she added, feeling that she was telling an untruth and was becoming entangled. She began to cry. "Mama, don't cry. Only tell me that you wish it, and you know I will give my life, anything, to put you at ease," said Nikolai. "I would sacrifice anything for you, even my feelings." But the Countess did not want the question put like that. She did not want a sacrifice from her son. She herself wished to make a sacrifice for him. "No, you have not understood me. Don't let's talk about it," she replied, wiping away her tears. "Maybe I do love a poor girl," said Nikolai to himself. "Am I to sacrifice my feelings and my honour for money? I wonder how Mama could speak so to me. Because Sonia is poor, I must not love her," he thought, "must not respond to her faithful, devoted love. Yet I should certainly be happier with her than with some doll like Julie. I can always sacrifice my feelings for my family's welfare," he said to himself, "but I can't coerce my feelings. If I love Sonia, that feeling is for me stronger and higher than all else." Nikolai did not go to Moscow, and the Countess did not renew the conversation with him about marriage. She saw, with sorrow and sometimes with exasperation, symptoms of a growing attachment between her son and the portionless Sonia. Though she blamed herself for it, she could not refrain from grumbling at and worrying Sonia, often pulling her up without reason, addressing her stiffly as "my dear," and using the formal "you" instead of the intimate "thou" in speaking to her. The kind-hearted Countess was the more vexed with Sonia because that poor, dark-eyed niece of hers was so meek, so kind, so devotedly grateful to her benefactors, and so faithfully, unchangingly, and unselfishly in love with Nikolai, that there were no grounds for finding fault with her. Nikolai was spending the last of his leave at home. A fourth letter had come from Prince Andrei from Rome, in which he wrote that he would have been on his way back to Russia long ago, had not his wound unexpectedly reopened in the warm climate, which obliged him to defer his return till the beginning of the new year. Natasha was still as much in love with her betrothed, found the same comfort in that love, and was still as ready to throw herself into all the pleasures of life as before. But at the end of the fourth month of their separation, she began to have fits of depression which she could not master. She felt sorry for herself, sorry that she was being wasted all this time and of no use to anyone, while she felt herself so capable of loving and being loved. Chapter 9. Christmas at Otradnoye. Christmas came, and except for the ceremonial mass, the solemn and wearisome Christmas congratulations from neighbours and servants, and the new dresses everyone put on, there were no special festivities, though the calm frost of 20 degrees Réaumur, the dazzling sunshine by day and the starlight of the winter nights seemed to call for some special celebration of the season. On the third day of Christmas week, after the midday dinner, all the inmates of the house dispersed to various rooms. It was the dullest time of the day. Nikolai, who had been visiting some neighbours that morning, was asleep on the sitting-room sofa. The old Count was resting in his study. Sonia sat in the drawing-room at the round table, copying a design for embroidery. The Countess was playing Patience. Nastasia Ivanovna, the buffoon, sat with a sad face at the window with two old ladies. Natasha came into the room and went up to Sonia, glanced at what she was doing, and then went up to her mother and stood without speaking. "Why are you wandering about like an outcast?" asked her mother. "What do you want?"
"Him. I want him. Now, this minute, I want him,"
said Natasha, with glittering eyes and no sign of a smile. The Countess lifted her head and looked attentively at her daughter.
"Don't look at me, Mama, don't look! I shall cry directly."
"Sit down with me a little," said the Countess.
"Mama, I want him. Why should I be wasted like this, Mama?"
Her voice broke, tears gushed from her eyes, and she turned quickly to hide them and left the room. She passed into the sitting room, stood there thinking a while, and then went into the maid's room. There an old maidservant was grumbling at a young girl who stood panting, having just run in through the cold from the serfs' quarters.
"Stop playing, there's a time for everything," said the old woman.
"Let her alone, Kondratevna," said Natasha. "Go, Mavrushka, go."
Having released Mavrushka, Natasha crossed the dancing hall and went to the vestibule. There an old footman and two young ones were playing cards. They broke off and rose as she entered.
"What can I do with them?" thought Natasha. "Oh, Nikita, please go..." "Where can I send him?"
"Yes, go to the yard and fetch a fowl, please, a cock, and you, Misha, bring me some oats."
"Just a few oats," said Misha, cheerfully and readily.
"Go, go, quickly," the old man urged him.
"And you, Theodore, get me a piece of chalk."
On her way past the butler's pantry, she told them to set a samovar, though it was not at all the time for tea. Foka, the butler, was the most ill-tempered person in the house. Natasha liked to test her power over him. He distrusted the order and asked whether the samovar was really wanted.
"Oh, dear, what a young lady," said Foka,
pretending to frown at Natasha. No one in the house sent people about or gave them as much trouble as Natasha did. She could not see people unconcernedly, but had to send them on some errand. She seemed to be trying whether any of them would get angry or sulky with her, but the serfs fulfilled no one's orders so readily as they did hers.
"What can I do? Where can I go?" thought she, as she went slowly along the passage. "Nastasya Ivanovna, what sort of children shall I have?" she asked the buffoon, who was coming toward her in a woman's jacket.
"Why, fleas, crickets, grasshoppers," answered the buffoon.
Oh, Lord, it's always the same. Oh, where am I to go? What am I to do with myself?"
And tapping with her heels, she ran quickly upstairs to see Fogel and his wife, who lived on the upper story. Two governesses were sitting with the Fogels at a table on which were plates of raisins, walnuts, and almonds. The governesses were discussing whether it was cheaper to live in Moscow or Odessa. Natasha sat down, listened to their talk with a serious and thoughtful air, and then got up again.
"The island of Madagascar," she said. "Madagascar,"
she repeated, articulating each syllable distinctly, and not replying to Madame Schoss, who asked her what she was saying, she went out of the room. Her brother Petya was upstairs, too. With the man in attendance on him, he was preparing fireworks to let off that night.
"Petya! Petya!" she called to him. "Carry me downstairs."
Petya ran up and offered her his back. She jumped on it, putting her arms round his neck, and he pranced along with her.
"No, don't! The island of Madagascar," she said, and jumping off his back, she went downstairs.
Having, as it were, reviewed her kingdom, tested her power, and made sure that everyone was submissive, but that all the same it was dull, Natasha betook herself to the ballroom, picked up her guitar, sat down in a dark corner behind a bookcase, and began to run her fingers over the strings in the bass, picking out a passage she recalled from an opera she had heard in Petersburg with Prince Andrei. What she drew from the guitar would have had no meaning for other listeners, but in her imagination a whole series of reminiscences arose from those sounds. She sat behind the bookcase with her eyes fixed on a streak of light escaping from the pantry door, and listened to herself and pondered. She was in a mood for brooding on the past. Sonya passed to the pantry, with a glass in her hand. Natasha glanced at her and at the crack in the pantry door, and it seemed to her that she remembered the light falling through that crack once before,
and Sonya passing with a glass in her hand.
Yes, it was exactly the same, thought Natasha. Sonya, what is this? She cried, twanging a thick string.
Oh, you're there,
said Sonya with a start and came near and listened.
I don't know.
A storm?
She ventured timidly, afraid of being wrong.
There, that's just how she started and just how she came up smiling timidly when all this happened before, thought Natasha. And in just the same way, I thought there was something lacking in her.
No, it's the chorus from the water carrier. Listen.
And Natasha sang the air of the chorus so that Sonya should catch it.
Where were you going?
She asked.
To change the water in this glass. I'm just finishing the design.
Hugh always finds something to do, but I can't, said Natasha. And where's Nikolai?
Asleep, I think.
Sonya, go and wake him, said Natasha. Tell him I want him to come and sing.
She sat a while, wondering what the meaning of it all having happened before could be, and without solving this problem, or at all regretting not having done so, she again passed in fancy to the time when she was with him, and he was looking at her with a lover's eyes.
Oh, if only he would come quicker. I'm so afraid it will never be. And worst of all, I am growing old, that's the thing. There won't then be in me what there is now. But perhaps he'll come today. We'll come immediately. Perhaps he has come, and is sitting in the drawing-room. Perhaps he came yesterday, and I've forgotten it.
She rose, put down the guitar, and went to the drawing-room. All the domestic circle, tutors, governesses, and guests were already at the tea-table. The servants stood round the table, but Prince Andrei was not there, and life was going on as before.
"Ah, here she is," said the old count when he saw Natasha enter. "Well, sit down by me."
But Natasha stayed by her mother and glanced round as if looking for something.
"Mama," she muttered. "Give him to me. Give him, Mama, quickly, quickly."
And she again had difficulty in repressing her sobs. She sat down at the table and listened to the conversation between the elders and Nikolai, who had also come to the table.
My God, the same faces, the same talk. Papa holding his cup and blowing in the same way, thought Natasha, feeling with horror a sense of repulsion rising up in her for the whole household, because they were always the same.
After tea, Nikolai, Sonya and Natasha went into the sitting-room, to their favourite corner where their most intimate talks always began. Chapter 10
"Does it ever happen to you?"
said Natasha to her brother when they settled down in the sitting-room.
"Does it ever happen to you to feel as if there were nothing more to come, nothing, that everything good is past, and to feel not exactly dull, but sad?"
"I should think so," he replied. "I've felt like that when everything was all right and everyone was cheerful. The thought has come into my mind that I was already tired of it all and that we must all die. Once in the regiment, I'd not gone to some merrymaking where there was music, and suddenly I felt so depressed."
"Oh, yes, I know, I know, I know," Natasha interrupted him. "When I was quite little, that used to be so with me. Do you remember when I was punished once about some plums? You were all dancing and I sat sobbing in the schoolroom. I shall never forget it. I felt sad and sorry for everyone, for myself and for everyone. And I was innocent. That was the chief thing," said Natasha. "Do you remember?"
"I remember," answered Nikolai. "I remember that I came to you afterwards and wanted to comfort you. But, do you know, I felt ashamed too. We were terribly absurd. I had a funny doll then and wanted to give it to you. Do you remember?"
"And do you remember," Natasha asked with a pensive smile, "how once long ago, when we were quite little, Uncle called us into the study, that was in the old house, and it was dark, and we went in, and suddenly there stood
a negro," chimed in Nikolai with a smile of delight. "Of course I remember. Even now I don't know whether there really was a negro, or if we only dreamed it and were told about him.
He was grey, you remember, and had white teeth, and stood and looked at us.
Sonia, do you remember? Asked Nikolai.
Yes, yes, I do remember something too, Sonia answered timidly. You know, I have asked Papa and Mama about that Negro, said Natasha, and they say there was no Negro at all. But you see, you remember.
Of course I do. I remember his teeth, as if I'd just seen them.
How strange it is. It's as if it were a dream. I like that. And do you remember how we rolled hard-boiled eggs in the ballroom, and suddenly two old women began spinning round on the carpet? Was that real or not? Do you remember what fun it was?
Yes, and do you remember how Papa in his blue overcoat fired a gun in the porch?
So they went through their memories, smiling with pleasure. Not the sad memories of old age, but poetic, youthful ones, those impressions of one's most distant past in which dreams and realities blend, and they laughed with quiet enjoyment. Sonia, as always, did not quite keep pace with them, though they shared the same reminiscences. Much that they remembered had slipped from her mind, and what she recalled did not arouse the same poetic feeling as they experienced. She simply enjoyed their pleasure and tried to fit in with it. She only really took part when they recalled Sonia's first arrival. She told them how afraid she had been of Nikolai because he had on a corded jacket, and her nurse had told her that she too would be sewn up with cords.
"And I remember their telling me that you had been born under a cabbage," said Natasha. "And I remember that I dared not disbelieve it then, but knew that it was not true, and I felt so uncomfortable."
While they were talking, a maid thrust her head in at the other door of the sitting room.
"They have brought the cock, miss," she said in a whisper.
"It isn't wanted. Petya, tell them to take it away," replied Natasha.
In the middle of their talk in the sitting room, Dimmler came in and went up to the harp that stood there in a corner. He took off its cloth covering and the harp gave out a jarring sound.
"Mr. Dimmler, please play my favourite nocturne by Field," came the old countess's voice from the drawing room.
Dimmler struck a chord and, turning to Natasha, Nikolai and Sonia, remarked, "How quiet you young people are."
"Yes, we're philosophizing," said Natasha, glancing round for a moment and then continuing the conversation.
They were now discussing dreams. Dimmler began to play. Natasha went on tiptoe noiselessly to the table, took up a candle, carried it out and returned, seating herself quietly in her former place. It was dark in the room, especially where they were sitting on the sofa, but through the big windows the silvery light of the full moon fell on the floor. Dimmler had finished the piece, but still sat softly running his fingers over the strings, evidently uncertain whether to stop or to play something else.
"Do you know,"
said Natasha in a whisper, moving closer to Nikolai and Sonia,
"that when one goes on and on recalling memories, one at last begins to remember what happened before one was in the world?" "That is metempsychosis," said Sonia, who had always learned well and remembered everything. "The Egyptians believed that our souls have lived in animals and will go back into animals again." "No, I don't believe we were ever in animals," said Natasha, still in a whisper, though the music had ceased. "But I am certain that we were angels somewhere there and have been here, and that is why we remember."
"May I join you?" said Dimmler, who had come up quietly, and he sat down by them. "If we have been angels, why have we fallen lower?" said Nikolai. "No, that can't be."
"Not lower? Who said we were lower? How do I know what I was before?" Natasha rejoined with conviction. "The soul is immortal. Well, then, if I shall always live, I must have lived before, lived for a whole eternity."
"Yes, but it is hard for us to imagine eternity," remarked Dimmler, who had joined the young folk with a mildly condescending smile, but now spoke as quietly and seriously as they.
"Why is it hard to imagine eternity?" said Natasha. "It is now, today, and it will be tomorrow and always, and there was yesterday and the day before."
"Natasha, now it's your turn,"
Sing me something," they heard the Countess say. "Why are you sitting there like conspirators?"
"Mamma, I don't at all want to," replied Natasha.
But all the same she rose. None of them, not even the middle-aged Dimmler, wanted to break off their conversation and quit that corner in the sitting-room, but Natasha got up and Nikolai sat down at the clavichord. Standing as usual in the middle of the hall and choosing the place where the resonance was best, Natasha began to sing her mother's favourite song. She had said she did not want to sing, but it was long since she had sung, and long before she again sang as she did that evening. The Count from his study, where he was talking to Mitenka, heard her, and like a schoolboy in a hurry to run out to play, blundered in his talk while giving orders to the steward, and at last stopped, while Mitenka stood in front of him, also listening and smiling. Nikolai did not take his eyes off his sister and drew breath in time with her. Sonya, as she listened, thought of the immense difference there was between herself and her friend, and how impossible it was for her to be anything like as bewitching as her cousin. The old Countess sat with a blissful yet sad smile, and with tears in her eyes, occasionally shaking her head. She thought of Natasha and of her own youth, and how there was something unnatural and dreadful in this impending marriage of Natasha and Prince Andrei. Dimmler, who had seated himself beside the Countess, listened with closed eyes. "Ah, Countess," he said at last, "that's a European talent. She has nothing to learn. What softness, tenderness, and strength!
Ah, how afraid I am for her, how afraid I am," said the Countess, not realizing to whom she was speaking.
Her maternal instinct told her that Natasha had too much of something, and that because of this she would not be happy. Before Natasha had finished singing, 14-year-old Petya rushed in delightedly to say that some mummers had arrived. Natasha stopped abruptly.
"Idiot!"
she screamed at her brother, and running to a chair, threw herself on it, sobbing so violently that she could not stop for a long time.
"It's nothing, Mamma. Really, it's nothing. Only Petya startled me," she said, trying to smile, but her tears still flowed and sobs still choked her.
The mummers, some of the house serfs, dressed up as bears, Turks, innkeepers and ladies, frightening and funny, bringing in with them the cold from outside and a feeling of gaiety, crowded at first timidly into the anteroom, then hiding behind one another, they pushed into the ballroom, where shyly at first and then more and more merrily and heartily, they started singing, dancing and playing Christmas games. The Countess, when she had identified them and laughed at their costumes, went into the drawing-room. The Count sat in the ballroom, smiling radiantly and applauding the players. The young people had disappeared. Half an hour later, there appeared among the other mummers in the ballroom an old lady in a hooped skirt, this was Nikolai, a Turkish girl was Petya, a clown was Dimmler, an hussar was Natasha, and a Circassian was Sonya, with burnt cork moustache and eyebrows. After the condescending surprise, non-recognition and praise from those who were not themselves dressed up, the young people decided that their costumes were so good that they ought to be shown elsewhere. Nikolai, who, as the roads were in splendid condition, wanted to take them all for a drive in his troika, proposed to take with them about a dozen of the serf mummers and drive to Uncle's.
"No, why disturb the old fellow?" said the Countess. "Besides, you wouldn't have room to turn round there. If you must go, go to the Melyukovs."
Melyukova was a widow who, with her family and their tutors and governesses, lived 3 miles from the Rostovs.
"That's right, my dear," chimed in the old Count, thoroughly aroused. "I'll dress up at once and go with them. I'll make Pashette open her eyes."
But the Countess would not agree to his going. He had had a bad leg all these last days. It was decided that the Count must not go, but that if Luisa Ivanovna, Madame Schoss, would go with them, the young ladies might go to the Melyukovs. Sonya, generally so timid and shy, more urgently than anyone, begging Luisa Ivanovna not to refuse. Sonia's costume was the best of all. Her moustache and eyebrows were extraordinarily becoming. Everyone told her she looked very handsome, and she was in a spirited and energetic mood unusual with her. Some inner voice told her that now or never her fate would be decided, and in her male attire she seemed quite a different person. Luisa Ivanovna consented to go, and in half an hour, four troika sleighs with large and small bells, their runners squeaking and whistling over the frozen snow, drove up to the porch. Natasha was foremost in setting a merry holiday tone, which, passing from one to another, grew stronger and reached its climax when they all came out into the frost and got into the sleighs, talking, calling to one another, laughing and shouting. Two of the troikas were the usual household sleighs. The third was the old count's, with a trotter from the Orlov stud as a shaft horse. The fourth was Nikolai's own, with a short, shaggy, black shaft horse. Nikolai, in his old lady's dress, over which he had belted his hussar overcoat, stood in the middle of the sleigh, reins in hand. It was so light that he could see the moonlight reflected from the metal harness discs and from the eyes of the horses, who looked round in alarm at the noisy party under the shadow of the porch roof. Natasha, Sonia, Madame Schoss, and two maids got into Nikolai's sleigh. Dimla, his wife, and Petya into the old count's, and the rest of the mummers seated themselves in the other two sleighs.
"You go ahead, Zachar!"
shouted Nikolai to his father's coachman, wishing for a chance to race past him. The old count's troika, with Dimla and his party, started forward, squeaking on its runners as though freezing to the snow, its deep-toned bell clanging. The side horses, pressing against the shafts of the middle horse, sank in the snow, which was dry and glittered like sugar, and threw it up. Nikolai set off, following the first sleigh. Behind him the others moved noisily, their runners squeaking. At first they drove at a steady trot along the narrow road. While they drove past the garden, the shadows of the bare trees often fell across the road and hid the brilliant moonlight. But as soon as they were past the fence, the snowy plain, bathed in moonlight and motionless, spread out before them, glittering like diamonds and dappled with bluish shadows. Bang! Bang! Went the first sleigh over a cradle hole in the snow of the road, and each of the other sleighs jolted in the same way, and rudely breaking the frost-bound stillness, the troikas began to speed along the road, one after the other.
"A hare's track! A lot of tracks!"
rang out Natasha's voice through the frost-bound air.
"How light it is, Nikolai!" came Sonia's voice.
Nikolai glanced round at Sonia and bent down to see her face closer. Quite a new, sweet face with black eyebrows and moustaches peeped up at him from her sable furs, so close and yet so distant in the moonlight. "That used to be Sonia," thought he, and looked at her closer and smiled.
"What is it, Nikolai?"
"Nothing," said he, and turned again to the horses. When they came out onto the beaten high road, polished by sleigh runners and cut up by roughshod hoofs, the marks of which were visible in the moonlight, the horses began to tug at the reins of their own accord and increased their pace. The near-side horse, arching his head and breaking into a short canter, tugged at his traces. The shaft horse swayed from side to side, moving his ears as if asking, "Isn't it time to begin now?" In front, already far ahead, the deep bell of the sleigh ringing farther and farther off, the black horses driven by Zachar could be clearly seen against the white snow. From that sleigh one could hear the shouts, laughter and voices of the mummers.
"Gee up, my darlings!" shouted Nikolai, pulling the reins to one side and flourishing the whip.
It was only by the keener wind that met them and the jerks given by the side horses who pulled harder, ever increasing their gallop, that one noticed how fast the troika was flying. Nikolai looked back. With screams, squeals, and waving of whips that caused even the shaft horses to gallop, the other sleighs followed. The shaft horse swung steadily beneath the bow over its head, with no thought of slackening pace and ready to put on speed when required. Nikolai overtook the first sleigh. They were driving downhill and coming out upon a broad, trodden track across a meadow near a river. "Where are we?" thought he.
It's the Kosoi meadow, I suppose. But no, this is something I've never seen before. This isn't the Kosoi meadow, nor the Dyomkin hill, and heaven only knows what it is. It's something new and enchanted. Well, whatever it may be. And shouting to his horses, he began to pass the first sleigh. Zahar held back his horses and turned his face, which was already covered with hoar frost, to his eyebrows. Nikolai gave the horses the rein, and Zahar, stretching out his arms, clucked his tongue and let his horses go. "Now, look out, master!" he cried. Faster still the two troikas flew side by side, and faster moved the feet of the galloping side horses. Nikolai began to draw ahead. Zahar, while still keeping his arms extended, raised one hand with the reins. "No, you won't, master!" he shouted. Nikolai put all his horses to a gallop and passed Zahar. The horses showered the fine, dry snow on the faces of those in the sleigh. Beside them sounded quick, ringing bells, and they caught confused glimpses of swiftly moving legs and the shadows of the troika they were passing. The whistling sound of the runners on the snow and the voices of girls shrieking were heard from different sides. Again checking his horses, Nikolai looked around him. They were still surrounded by the magic plain, bathed in moonlight and spangled with stars. "Zahar is shouting that I should turn to the left, but why to the left?" thought Nikolai. "Are we getting to the Melyukovs? Is this Melyukovka? Heaven only knows where we're going, and heaven knows what is happening to us, but it is very strange and pleasant, whatever it is." And he looked round in the sleigh. "Look, his moustache and eyelashes are all white," said one of the strange, pretty, unfamiliar people, the one with fine eyebrows and moustache. "I think this used to be Natasha," thought Nikolai. "And that was Madame Schoss. But perhaps it's not. And this Circassian with the moustache, I don't know, but I love her." "Aren't you cold?" he asked. They did not answer, but began to laugh. Dimmler from the sleigh behind shouted something, probably something funny, but they could not make out what he said. "Yes, yes!" some voices answered, laughing. But here was a fairy forest with black moving shadows, and a glitter of diamonds, and a flight of marble steps, and the silver roofs of fairy buildings, and the shrill yells of some animals. And if this is really Melyukovka, it is still stranger that we drove heaven knows where and have come to Melyukovka, thought Nikolai. It really was Melyukovka, and maids and footmen with merry faces came running out to the porch carrying candles. "Who is it?" asked someone in the porch. "The mummers from the Count's. I know by the horses," replied some voices. Chapter 11. At Melyukovka. Pelageya Danilovna Melyukova, a broadly built, energetic woman wearing spectacles, sat in the drawing-room in a loose dress, surrounded by her daughters, whom she was trying to keep from feeling dull. They were quietly dropping melted wax into snow and looking at the shadows the wax figures would throw on the wall, when they heard the steps and voices of new arrivals in the vestibule. Hussars, ladies, witches, clowns and bears, after clearing their throats and wiping the hoarfrost from their faces in the vestibule, came into the ballroom where candles were hurriedly lighted. The clown, Dimmler, and the lady, Nikolai, started a dance. Surrounded by the screaming children, the mummers, covering their faces and disguising their voices, bowed to their hostess and arranged themselves about the room.
"Dear me, there's no recognizing them. And Natasha, see whom she looks like. She really reminds me of somebody. But Herr Dimmler, isn't he good? I didn't know him, and how he dances. Dear me, there's a Circassian. Really, how becoming it is to dear Sonya. And who is that? Well, you have cheered us up. Nikita and Vanya, clear away the tables. And we were sitting so quietly.
Ho, 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 the hussar, the hussar, just like a boy. And the legs, I can't look at him,"
different voices were saying. Natasha, the young Melyukov's favourite, disappeared with them into the back rooms, where a cork and various dressing gowns and male garments were called for and received from the footman by bare girlish arms from behind the door. 10 minutes later, all the young Melyukovs joined the mummers. Pelageya Danilovna, having given orders to clear the rooms for the visitors and arranged about refreshments for the gentry and the serfs, went about among the mummers without removing her spectacles, peering into their faces with a suppressed smile and failing to recognize any of them. It was not merely Dimmler and the Rostovs she failed to recognize. She did not even recognize her own daughters or her late husband's dressing gowns and uniforms which they had put on.
"And who is this?"
she asked her governess, peering into the face of her own daughter, dressed up as a Kazan Tartar.
"I suppose it is one of the Rostovs. Well, Mr. Hussar, and what regiment do you serve in?"
she asked Natasha.
"Here, hand some fruit jelly to the Turk,"
she ordered the butler, who was handing things round.
"That's not forbidden by his law."
Sometimes, as she looked at the strange but amusing capers cut by the dancers, who, having decided once for all that being disguised no one would recognize them, were not shy, Pelageya Danilovna hid her face in her handkerchief, and her whole stout body shook with irrepressible, kindly, elderly laughter.
"My little Sasha! Look at Sasha!" she said.
After Russian country dances and chorus dances, Pelageya Danilovna made the serfs and gentry join in one large circle. A ring, a string, and a silver ruble were fetched, and they all played games together. In an hour, all the costumes were crumpled and disordered. The corked eyebrows and moustaches were smeared over the perspiring, flushed and merry faces. Pelageya Danilovna began to recognize the mummers, admired their cleverly contrived costumes, and particularly how they suited the young ladies, and she thanked them all for having entertained her so well. The visitors were invited to supper in the drawing-room, and the serfs had something served up to them in the ballroom. During supper, an old maid who lived with the Melyukovs said,
"Now to tell one's fortune in the empty bathhouse is frightening."
"Why?" said the eldest Melyukov girl.
"You wouldn't go. It takes courage."
"I'll go," said Sonya. "Tell what happened to the young lady," said the second Melyukov girl.
"Well," began the old maid, "a young lady once went out, took a cock, laid the table for two, all properly, and sat down. After a while, she suddenly hears someone coming. A sleigh drives up with harness bells. She hears him coming. He comes in, just in the shape of a man, like an officer. Comes in and sits down to table with her."
"Ah! Oh!" screamed Natasha, rolling her eyes with horror.
"Yes, and how did he speak?"
"Yes, like a man. Everything quite all right. And he began persuading her, and she should have kept him talking till cockcrow, but she got frightened, just got frightened and hid her face in her hands. Then he caught her up. It was lucky the maids ran in just then."
"Now, why frighten them?" said Pelageya Danilovna.
"Mamma, you used to try your fate yourself," said her daughter.
"And how does one do it in a barn?" inquired Sonya.
"Well, say you went to the barn now and listened. It depends on what you hear. Hammering and knocking, that's bad. But a sound of shifting grain is good, and one sometimes hears that too."
"Mamma, tell us what happened to you in the barn," Pelageya Danilovna smiled.
"Oh, I've forgotten," she replied. "But none of you would go."
"Yes, I will go. Pelageya Danilovna, let me, I'll go," said Sonya.
"Well, why not, if you're not afraid?"
"Luisa Ivanovna, may I?" asked Sonya.
Whether they were playing the ring and string game or the ruble game or talking as now, Nikolai did not leave Sonya's side and gazed at her with quite new eyes. It seemed to him that it was only today, thanks to that burnt cork moustache, that he had fully learned to know her. And really, that evening Sonya was brighter, more animated and prettier than Nikolai had ever seen her before. "So that's what she is like. What a fool I have been," he thought, gazing at her sparkling eyes, and under the moustache a happy, rapturous smile dimpled her cheeks, a smile he had never seen before.
"I'm not afraid of anything," said Sonya. "May I go at once?" She got up.
They told her where the barn was and how she should stand and listen, and they handed her a fur cloak. She threw this over her head and shoulders and glanced at Nikolai.
"What a darling that girl is," thought he, "and what have I been thinking of till now?"
Sonya went out into the passage to go to the barn. Nikolai went hastily to the front porch, saying he felt too hot. The crowd of people really had made the house stuffy. Outside, there was the same cold stillness and the same moon, but even brighter than before. The light was so strong, and the snow sparkled with so many stars that one did not wish to look up at the sky, and the real stars were unnoticed. The sky was black and dreary, while the earth was gay. "I am a fool, a fool! What have I been waiting for?" thought Nikolai, and running out from the porch, he went round the corner of the house and along the path that led to the back porch. He knew Sonya would pass that way. Halfway lay some snow-covered piles of firewood, and across and along them a network of shadows from the bare old lime trees fell on the snow and on the path. This path led to the barn. The log walls of the barn and its snow-covered roof, that looked as if hewn out of some precious stone, sparkled in the moonlight. A tree in the garden snapped with the frost, and then all was again perfectly silent. His bosom seemed to inhale not air, but the strength of eternal youth and gladness. From the back porch came the sound of feet descending the steps. The bottom step, upon which snow had fallen, gave a ringing creak, and he heard the voice of an old maidservant saying,
"Straight, straight along the path, miss, only don't look back."
"I'm not afraid," answered Sonya's voice, and along the path toward Nikolai came the crunching, whistling sound of Sonya's feet in her thin shoes. Sonya came along, wrapped in her cloak. She was only a couple of paces away when she saw him, and to her, too, he was not the Nikolai she had known and always slightly feared. He was in a woman's dress, with tousled hair and a happy smile new to Sonya. She ran rapidly toward him.
"Quite different, and yet the same," thought Nikolai, looking at her face all lit up by the moonlight.
He slipped his arms under the cloak that covered her head, embraced her, pressed her to him, and kissed her on the lips that wore a moustache and had a smell of burnt cork. Sonya kissed him full on the lips, and disengaging her little hands, pressed them to his cheeks.
"Sonya!"
"Nikolai!" was all they said. They ran to the barn and then back again, re-entering, he by the front and she by the back porch. Chapter 12. The Drive Home. When they all drove back from Pelageya Danilovna's, Natasha, who always saw and noticed everything, arranged that she and Madame Schoss should go back in the sleigh with Dimla and Sonya with Nikolai and the maids. On the way back, Nikolai drove at a steady pace instead of racing, and kept peering by that fantastic all-transforming light into Sonya's face and searching beneath the eyebrows and moustache for his former and his present Sonya, from whom he had resolved never to be parted again. He looked, and recognizing in her both the old and the new Sonya, and being reminded by the smell of burnt cork of the sensation of her kiss, inhaled the frosty air with a full breast, and looking at the ground flying beneath him and at the sparkling sky, felt himself again in fairyland.
"Sonya, is it well with thee?" he asked from time to time.
"Yes," she replied. "And with thee?" When halfway home, Nikolai handed the reins to the coachman and ran for a moment to Natasha's sleigh and stood on its wing.
"Natasha," he whispered in French, "do you know I have made up my mind about Sonya?"
"Have you told her?" asked Natasha, suddenly beaming all over with joy.
"Oh, how strange you are with that moustache and those eyebrows. Natasha, are you glad?"
"I'm so glad, so glad. I was beginning to be vexed with you. I did not tell you, but you have been treating her badly. What a heart she has, Nikolai. I am horrid sometimes, but I was ashamed to be happy while Sonya was not," continued Natasha. "Now I am so glad. Well,
run back to her.
No, wait a bit. Oh, how funny you look, cried Nikolai, peering into her face and finding in his sister too something new, unusual, and bewitchingly tender that he had not seen in her before.
Natasha, it's magical, isn't it?
Yes, she replied.
You have done splendidly.
Had I seen her before as she is now, thought Nikolai, I should long ago have asked her what to do and have done whatever she told me, and all would have been well.
So you're glad, and I have done right?
Oh, quite right. I had a quarrel with Mama some time ago about it.
Mama said she was angling for you. How could she say such a thing? I nearly stormed at Mama. I will never let anyone say anything bad of Sonia, for there is nothing but good in her.
Then it's all right, said Nikolai, again scrutinizing the expression of his sister's face to see if she was in earnest. Then he jumped down, and his boots scrunching the snow, ran back to his sleigh. The same happy, smiling Circassian, with moustache and beaming eyes looking up from under a sable hood, was still sitting there. And that Circassian was Sonia, and that Sonia was certainly his future, happy and loving wife. When they reached home and had told their mother how they had spent the evening at the Melyukovs, the girls went to their bedroom. When they had undressed, but without washing off the cork moustaches, they sat a long time talking of their happiness. They talked of how they would live when they were married, of how their husbands would be friends, and how happy they would be. On Natasha's table stood two looking-glasses, which Dunyasha had prepared beforehand.
"Only, when will all that be? I am afraid never. It would be too good," said Natasha, rising and going to the looking-glasses. "Sit down, Natasha. Perhaps you'll see him," said Sonia.
Natasha lit the candles, one on each side of the looking-glasses, and sat down.
"I see someone with a moustache," said Natasha, seeing her own face.
"You mustn't laugh, miss," said Dunyasha.
With Sonia's help and the maid's, Natasha got the glass she held into the right position opposite the other. Her face assumed a serious expression, and she sat silent. She sat a long time looking at the receding line of candles reflected in the glasses, and expecting, from tales she had heard, to see a coffin, or him, Prince Andrei, in that last dim, indistinctly outlined square. But ready as she was to take the smallest speck for the image of a man or of a coffin, she saw nothing. She began blinking rapidly and moved away from the looking-glasses.
"Why is it others see things and I don't?" she said. "You sit down now, Sonia. You absolutely must tonight. Do it for me. Today I feel so frightened."
Sonia sat down before the glasses, got the right position, and began looking.
"Now Miss Sonia is sure to see something," whispered Dunyasha, "while you do nothing but laugh."
Sonia heard this and Natasha's whisper.
"I know she will. She saw something last year."
For about 3 minutes, all were silent.
"Of course she will,"
whispered Natasha, but did not finish. Suddenly Sonia pushed away the glass she was holding and covered her eyes with her hand.
"Oh, Natasha," she cried.
"Did you see? Did you? What was it?"
exclaimed Natasha, holding up the looking-glass. Sonia had not seen anything. She was just wanting to blink and to get up when she heard Natasha say, "Of course she will." She did not wish to disappoint either Dunyasha or Natasha, but it was hard to sit still. She did not herself know how or why the exclamation escaped her when she covered her eyes.
"You saw him?"
urged Natasha, seizing her hand.
"Yes, wait a bit. I saw him,"
Sonia could not help saying, not yet knowing whom Natasha meant by him, Nikolai or Prince Andrei.
"But why shouldn't I say I saw something? Others do see. Besides, who can tell whether I saw anything or not?"
flashed through Sonia's mind.
"Yes, I saw him," she said. "How? Standing or lying?" "No, I saw... At first there was nothing. Then I saw him lying down." Andrei, lying, is he ill?
Asked Natasha, her frightened eyes fixed on her friend.
No, on the contrary, his face was cheerful, and he turned to me.
And when saying this, she herself fancied she had really seen what she described.
Well, and then, Sonya?
After that, I could not make out what there was, something blue and red.
Sonya, when will he come back? When shall I see him? Oh, God, how afraid I am for him and for myself and about everything.
Natasha began, and without replying to Sonya's words of comfort, she got into bed, and long after her candle was out, lay open-eyed and motionless, gazing at the moonlight through the frosty window panes. Chapter 13. Nikolai's mother opposes his choice of bride. Soon after the Christmas holidays, Nikolai told his mother of his love for Sonya and of his firm resolve to marry her. The Countess, who had long noticed what was going on between them and was expecting this declaration, listened to him in silence and then told her son that he might marry whom he pleased, but that neither she nor his father would give their blessing to such a marriage. Nikolai, for the first time, felt that his mother was displeased with him and that despite her love for him, she would not give way. Coldly, without looking at her son, she sent for her husband, and when he came, tried briefly and coldly to inform him of the facts in her son's presence, but unable to restrain herself, she burst into tears of vexation and left the room. The old count began irresolutely to admonish Nikolai and beg him to abandon his purpose. Nikolai replied that he could not go back on his word, and his father, sighing and evidently disconcerted, very soon became silent and went in to the countess. In all his encounters with his son, the count was always conscious of his own guilt towards him for having wasted the family fortune, and so he could not be angry with him for refusing to marry an heiress and choosing the dowerless Sonya. On this occasion, he was only more vividly conscious of the fact that if his affairs had not been in disorder, no better wife for Nikolai than Sonya could have been wished for, and that no one but himself, with his Mitenka and his uncomfortable habits, was to blame for the condition of the family finances. The father and mother did not speak of the matter to their son again, but a few days later, the countess sent for Sonya, and with a cruelty neither of them expected, reproached her niece for trying to catch Nikolai and for ingratitude. Sonya listened silently with downcast eyes to the countess's cruel words, without understanding what was required of her. She was ready to sacrifice everything for her benefactors. Self-sacrifice was her most cherished idea, but in this case she could not see what she ought to sacrifice or for whom. She could not help loving the Countess and the whole Rostov family, but neither could she help loving Nikolai, and knowing that his happiness depended on that love. She was silent and sad, and did not reply. Nikolai felt the situation to be intolerable, and went to have an explanation with his mother. He first implored her to forgive him and Sonya and consent to their marriage. Then he threatened that if she molested Sonya, he would at once marry her secretly. The Countess, with a coldness her son had never seen in her before, replied that he was of age, that Prince Andrei was marrying without his father's consent, and he could do the same, but that she would never receive that intriguer as her daughter. Exploding at the word intriguer, Nikolai, raising his voice, told his mother he had never expected her to try to force him to sell his feelings, but if that were so, he would say for the last time. But he had no time to utter the decisive word, which the expression of his face caused his mother to await with terror, and which would perhaps have forever remained a cruel memory to them both. He had not time to say it, for Natasha, with a pale and set face, entered the room from the door at which she had been listening.
"Nikolai, you're talking nonsense! Be quiet, be quiet, be quiet, I tell you!"
she almost screamed so as to drown his voice.
"Mama, darling, it's not at all so, my poor sweet darling," she said to her mother, who, conscious that they had been on the brink of a rupture, gazed at her son with terror,
but in the obstinacy and excitement of the conflict could not and would not give way.
"Nikolai, I'll explain to you. Go away." "Listen, Mama, darling," said Natasha.
Her words were incoherent, but they attained the purpose at which she was aiming. The Countess, sobbing heavily, hid her face on her daughter's breast, while Nikolai rose, clutching his head, and left the room. Natasha set to work to effect a reconciliation, and so far succeeded that Nikolai received a promise from his mother that Sonya should not be troubled, while he, on his side, promised not to undertake anything without his parents' knowledge. Firmly resolved, after putting his affairs in order in the regiment, to retire from the army and return and marry Sonya, Nikolai, serious, sorrowful, and at variance with his parents, but, as it seemed to him, passionately in love, left at the beginning of January to rejoin his regiment. After Nikolai had gone, things in the Rostov household were more depressing than ever, and the Countess fell ill from mental agitation. Sonya was unhappy at the separation from Nikolai, and still more so on account of the hostile tone the Countess could not help adopting toward her. The Count was more perturbed than ever by the condition of his affairs, which called for some decisive action. Their townhouse and estate near Moscow had inevitably to be sold, and for this they had to go to Moscow. But the Countess's health obliged them to delay their departure from day to day. Natasha, who had borne the first period of separation from her betrothed lightly and even cheerfully, now grew more agitated and impatient every day. The thought that her best days, which she would have employed in loving him, were being vainly wasted, with no advantage to anyone, tormented her incessantly. His letters, for the most part, irritated her. It hurt her to think that while she lived only in the thought of him, he was living a real life, seeing new places and new people that interested him. The more interesting his letters were, the more vexed she felt. Her letters to him, far from giving her any comfort, seemed to her a wearisome and artificial obligation. She could not write, because she could not conceive the possibility of expressing sincerely in a letter even a thousandth part of what she expressed by voice, smile, and glance. She wrote to him formal, monotonous, and dry letters, to which she attached no importance herself, and in the rough copies of which the Countess corrected her mistakes in spelling. There was still no improvement in the Countess's health, but it was impossible to defer the journey to Moscow any longer. Natasha's trousseau had to be ordered and the house sold. Moreover, Prince Andrei was expected in Moscow, where old Prince Bolkonsky was spending the winter, and Natasha felt sure he had already arrived. So the Countess remained in the country, and the Count, taking Sonya and Natasha with him, went to Moscow at the end of January. Book 8, 1811-1812. Chapter 1. Pierre's Life in Moscow. After Prince Andrei's engagement to Natasha, Pierre, without any apparent cause, suddenly felt it impossible to go on living as before. Firmly convinced as he was of the truths revealed to him by his benefactor, and happy as he had been in perfecting his inner man, to which he had devoted himself with such ardour, all the zest of such a life vanished after the engagement of Andrei and Natasha and the death of Joseph Alexeyevich, the news of which reached him almost at the same time. Only the skeleton of life remained: his house, a brilliant wife who now enjoyed the favours of a very important personage, acquaintance with all Petersburg, and his court service with its dull formalities. And this life suddenly seemed to Pierre unexpectedly loathsome. He ceased keeping a diary, avoided the company of the brothers, began going to the club again, drank a great deal, and came once more in touch with the bachelor sets, leading such a life that the Countess Hélène thought it necessary to speak severely to him about it. Pierre felt that she was right, and to avoid compromising her, went away to Moscow. In Moscow, as soon as he entered his huge house in which the faded and fading princesses still lived, with its enormous retinue, As soon as driving through the town he saw the Iberian shrine with innumerable tapers burning before the golden covers of the icons, the Kremlin square with its snow undisturbed by vehicles, the sleigh drivers and the hovels of Sivtsev Vrazhok, those old Muscovites who desired nothing, hurried nowhere,